Hello and welcome to another edition of the Ice World podcast. This is a special Christmas themed episode about the animals that might first spring to mind when you think about Antarctica. I am joined today by Peter Fretwell, who's based at the British Antarctic Survey's headquarters in Cambridge, and Darren Fox, who has kindly joined us live from Cygni Research Station at 60 degrees of southerly latitude, where he is ready to spend Christmas. I first met Darren in 2020 as we sailed together on the James Clark Ross during the COVID period. He was diligently on the Monkey Island each morning, so that's the highest point of the ship. And he had a huge camera and was telling me all about the birds we were seeing flying before our eyes across the Atlantic and the Southern Ocean. Peter is famous in the world and leading the field of remote sensing and is currently based at the headquarters of the British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge. This is a Christmas-themed episode, and maybe it doesn't have as much fun and laughter as we would think around the festive period, but it brings such an important message about the conservation and the issue that penguin populations are facing today.
Hello, my name's Darren Fox. I'm a zoological field assistant with British Antarctic Survey, so I work on mostly on the penguins' long-term monitoring work on Cygni.
Amazing. And how long have you been working towards long-term collection with the British Antarctic Survey?
I started in 2007 with Bass and had a few years down on Bird Island and Cygni, about 4 years, and then was let off for good behaviour for about 8 years, and then I've come back.
Let off for good behaviour. Well, I mean, you're actually being really modest because you've just told me that you've done 3 winters at Bird Island and this is now your 7th summer at Cygni. So that is an impressive amount of time on working on Antarctic islands.
Yeah, I'm very, very lucky. So, yeah.
What made you want to go to Antarctica?
It was the albatrosses initially. So I used to work with RSPB and I still do during the summer. I worked for them for about 10 or 15 years and fell in love with seabirds up in Scotland and then saw the ZFA job, the zoological field assistant job on Bird Island to work, go and work with albatrosses. And that was the only thing that was going to drag me away from Scottish seabirds.
And Peter? You're really famous in the Antarctic world. You're leading the field of remote sensing, or one of the leaders at least. You've already featured in a podcast, which people can find online, called A Voyage to Antarctica. And that was hosted by the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust, where you talk quite a lot about the details of remote sensing techniques. So we'll try to avoid overlap in this episode. So please, could you tell me where it all started and how long have you been working with the British Antarctic Survey?
I've been working here about 23 years, I think, now. I started really as a cartographer and then I learned remote sensing, satellite imagery and UAVs and sort of spatial analysis and then went on to study a variety of things, but really have honed in more recently on studying wildlife using satellite imagery. So for the last 10 or 15 years, we've been really leading the field in looking at really remote places and the wildlife and trying to detect, count and monitor those wildlife and study their behaviour. But some of the places, certainly in Antarctica, are just almost impossible to get to. So using satellites is a real game changer, really, to be able to see them and study these fantastic creatures from the beauty of your own office often.
So, Darren, it is the height of summer for you, and you're about to hit the solstice, so you are bathed in that 24 hours of sunlight at Cygni. How many of there are you on station right now?
There's 5 of us here at the moment, so quite a small team. We can have up to 8 people here, so that's a maximum we can have up to 8. So yes, yeah, quite a quiet Christmas, really. And we haven't seen the sunshine for, despite it being daylight, it's quite cloudy, wet and miserable a lot of the time here. So yeah, being bathed in 24-hour sunlight does not happen.
I think I wrote that dreaming of my favourite Antarctic experiences when you do get sun and you can walk in shorts and T-shirt. But I'm sorry for you that you don't have that. So after this morning's podcast, will you be going out to do any field work today?
I will, yeah. I'm pretty much every single day I'm out and about, which is what makes it such a special job, really. So I'll be going back over to Gourlay, which is my main study site, and carrying on. A lot of the work I do is fairly sort of basic natural history. So we're looking at productivity of the penguins. So every day or two, I'll go over and check 100 chinstrap and 100 are daily nests, so to see how they're doing, how many chicks they're having, how many eggs, and things like this, and to look at that sort of basic productivity.
And where are the chinstraps and the adelies at the moment? How many chicks have they got? Or have they got any eggs at the moment?
So the adelies are kind of peak hatching at the moment. So there's lots of chicks popping out at the minute, which is quite an exciting time, really. So as I wander through the colony, so I have to sort of check under the penguins, which we technically call bum lifting, which is basically holding the back of the penguin and lifting them very gently up. I'm a trained professional, but lifting them gently up and to see whether they've hatched or how many eggs they've got and stuff. So we do this very carefully, and I'm the only one who does it. So at the moment, the adelies are sort of hatching, so there's lots of young chicks coming out, and you can hear them. One of the nice things is you can hear them pipping still inside the egg. So as they get closer to hatching, you can hear this like little peeping sound inside, and then you'll see them as they start to break through the egg. You'll see like a tiny little hole and the egg tooth of the chick as it starts to come out, and then it'll take a day or two to actually come out of the egg. So you can hear this sort of process going on over a few days as I go around and check them. The chin straps are about 3 to 4 weeks behind the adelies, which is normal. That's what they do. They've all just finished laying. So we've just been round and doing a big count of all the study colonies around the island.
And how many eggs would chinstraps have, roughly?
Chinnies and adelies both have two eggs. So unlike the emperors and the kings, some of the bigger penguins, they have two eggs, which is fairly normal. And in a good year, they'll have a couple of chicks and hopefully fledge sort of the majority of those. But it's, yeah.
Peter, have you ever encountered bum lifting in your wildlife survey work?
No, I've seen lots of chinstraps and adelies, but most of the science I've done has been on emperors, and we can't get there really in the time when they've got eggs, because they actually lay their eggs in the middle of the winter. And we only really get there in the spring when we've got the chicks. So we see the young chicks, we see them in the brood pouches, but we don't get to see the eggs. Although I have tried to weigh an emperor penguin. An emperor penguin can weigh up to 45 kilograms, and they don't like being picked up, so it's not advisable to try and weigh an emperor penguin. It's like lifting up a teenager, basically, an angry teenager. Yeah, hard work.
Wow. And where were you trying to weigh a 45 kilogram penguin?
This was last year, actually. We were putting tags on emperor penguins down at Snow Hill Island on the eastern side of the peninsula. And we had the thought, well, we could try and weigh them while we were there. But after we tried, I think the first one, it was quite obvious that weighing them wasn't going to be an option, not with the equipment that we had. We'd need some serious equipment to pick up the bigger ones.
Were you trying to use scales that you'd suspend in the air and hang a bag on the bottom of the scales?
Yeah, basically, that was it. We had a harness and a handheld scale, and so it just wasn't going to work, so we gave up after the first one, I think.
Wow, you almost need something like the weighbridge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Darren, can you tell us about the weighbridge of how you actually could weigh a penguin?
Yeah, so we do weigh the penguins here. I don't envy you trying to weigh a 45-kilo emperor, because I've never seen such angry balls of muscle as just the adelies and the chin straps, which are around like 5 kilos, and they're bad enough. So I can't imagine what an emperor's like. So we weigh ours. So we weigh the chicks when they're leaving, just to get an idea of the health of the population. And we weigh some of the birds when they're coming back in as well. But we pop them very gently in a bag and then hang them, sort of suspend them on a balance as well. So, yeah, the weighbridge, which is over on Bird Island, weighs the macaroni penguins. Most of the birds within that colony have been pit tagged, like you'd chip your pets back home. So when those birds go back to the colony, and when they leave the colony, they're then weighed as they come across this little weighbridge, which is not as easy as it sounds, because they don't just come onto the scales and sit quite happily there. They bounce across. Sometimes they'll come across two or three together. Sometimes they'll get halfway on and run back again and stuff. So yeah, some very clever maths and some brighter minds than me have worked out how to weigh the penguins as they bounce across a scale. So we did quite a lot of calibration of this. So we were catching the penguins at times once they'd gone through the weighbridge to calibrate them, so we know how heavy they were, and then you can look at the track on that is it. So basically, if you jumped onto your bathroom scales and then jumped back off again, this is what they're doing down there.
So impressive. Peter, do you think you could have taken that to Snow Hill Island?
Very unlikely, because the emperors breed on sea ice, so they're not on permanent land anywhere, and they come in from all angles. There's the good thing about an island like Bird Island is they tend to use the same paths up the terrain, so you can place a bridge in the right place. Where if you've just got a flat ice landscape, you've got no idea which way the birds are going to come from.
What's it like to see a penguin up close? What kind of behaviours do you enjoy watching them do?
Depending what penguin you get very different. You know, the smaller ones, the chin straps, the dailies and gentoos, they can be quite comic. They're full of fun. They're really nice. One of the great things about them is that they're not really scared of people so much. You know, if you sit down, they'll come up and pick your shoes. Whereas the emperors are much more stately. They tend to be much more genteel and do things much slower than the feisty little penguins, which in their dailies especially I find particularly feisty and will argue and shout and fight and things, whereas the emperors are a little bit more sedate and imperious, let's say.
Darren, how does that contrast with your little penguins over at Cygni?
Yeah, I can relate to Peter's comments about the adelies being quite feisty. They're very, certainly very comical, and it's lovely just to sit and watch them. They do that classic stealing stones off each other and things like that, which is always good to see. And they are very angry at times towards each other as well as me. So they'll quite often, for some reason, they'll just take it upon themselves to like attack one of who's getting through the colony, because the adelies, certainly, they nest just far enough apart that they can't quite reach each other. So, but then to get to another nest, they've got to go between all the other nests. So they'll get bitten and whacked, and occasionally they'll just get chased right through the colony and out the other side by another penguin. And then they'll grasp the penguin on the back of their body with their beak and then just batter them really, really hard with the flippers. It's one of the most painful things. It's like being hit with a ruler like we used to do at school when I was a child, but really, really hard and quickly. So they do this all the time. And unfortunately, I have to go between all the nests to check them. So whilst I'm bending down, trying to look under one, trying to keep calm, there's about three or four attacking my ankles and shins. So I'm covered in bruises and bite marks for most of the summer.
So when you go home and people ask you what those bruises are from, I think you've got a great story to tell. And other than weighing the penguins, Darren, what other data are you collecting about the penguins when you go out every day?
So most of this is the productivity side of things. So we've got these marked nests. So we don't disturb all the penguins. We're very careful that we do like a very small sample, but it has to be enough to sort of like get significant results. So we've got 100 chinstrap, 100 adelie nests, and every few days I'll go through. So we're getting lay dates for those birds. We're getting an idea of the number of eggs each one lays, and then hatch dates as well. So we get all that kind of information. And then at the end of the season, so we're looking at the sort of productivity side of things and seeing how many chicks they're actually successfully fledging. And we're also looking at the kind of health of those chicks as well when they leave. So we're weighing the chicks as well, which is probably the best fun you can have, is trying to catch baby penguins. So we go out, pretty much everyone on station comes out for that. It's quite popular. It's not the cleanest fun you can have, trying to catch penguins and then put them in a bag and weigh them and then release them. And it's lovely to see them sort of actually leaving the island finally after the season. So you'll see them kind of flapping around in the water. They're not natural swimmers when they first go into the water. They'll flap around on the surface for a little bit, and then all of a sudden they'll just duck under and they just go. It's incredible. Yeah, they kind of finally sort of realize what they're supposed to be doing. So.
Like their instincts kick in as soon as they hit that marine environment. Amazing. Is there a limit to the weather conditions that you can work in with these penguins, or are you just constantly out battling the Antarctic forces?
Yeah, there's only so much I can cope with. The poor penguin seems to just carry on regardless. But yeah, so depending on what we're doing as well. So if it's just going and counting the birds for the day, then we can do that in pretty much any weather. But we do get some quite extreme weather, as you can imagine. So yeah, we can get knocked around a little bit by the weather as well. So yeah, certainly wind and snow blizzards and all these kind of things play a big part in it, and also trying to get to the colonies as well. So half of the work I do is over the ice cap, so when it's a bad weather day, getting over there is more of a problem than doing the work a lot of the time. But I've regularly gone to the penguin colonies and thinking my birds have disappeared and just had to dig down through the snow, and they're quite snug and sitting on their eggs still.
It sounds like you've got the dream job, but does it ever get boring?
No, not really. When it does, and when it feels like a proper job, I'll give it up so somebody else can do it, because it's such a privilege. It really is. I do have to do data entry, which is probably one. So I've got a lot of very smelly, dirty notebooks, which I then have to input into a database. And occasionally that gets a bit boring, but it also makes me rest slightly. So I'm not getting any younger. So it's nice to have a day in the office sometimes.
Do you have figures off the top of your head, roughly, of the success rate of Adelies and chinstrap penguins at the moment?
Here, our chinstrap and Adelie populations are unfortunately going down quite dramatically, and have been for decades now, which is sort of very sad to see. So some of our colonies have actually completely disappeared from the island. They've become so small that they're not viable anymore, and then they've disappeared from the island completely.
That must be so hard for you to see, given that you've been experiencing this over the last 12 years. How do you find that?
Yeah, it's year on year, you kind of come back and we've got figures, so you can see statistically, you can see the population going down, which is, it's quite hard to relate to in many ways. But when you come, I had a gap where I came here about 11 years ago for a first season and then went away again. And when I came back to see the place, there were some of the colonies that I used to study had disappeared completely. And that was, it's a real kind of like hard line in the sand. And that's quite upsetting when you see that, rather than just a slightly smaller colony or a figure on a piece of paper saying, oh, there's less than there used to be. So yeah, when you actually see that kind of hard line in the sand where a small, admittedly there were small colonies. We get lots of small colonies. It's not like we have hundreds of thousands of them here. We have a few thousand in some of the bigger colonies, but some of the small ones actually disappearing completely is quite upsetting. You can actually see it sort of in real life.
And Peter, you're seeing this in a different way. You're seeing the breakup and complete disappearance of emperor penguin colonies from satellite imagery. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so as I said, often it's really hard to get to the emperor penguin colonies, and the only way we can monitor them really is from space, by satellite. And what we've seen recently is that the sea ice on which they live and breed is starting to break up earlier and earlier. And certainly across the Antarctic Peninsula and the areas further to the north in Antarctica, if it breaks up before the chicks have got their waterproof feathers in late December, then it probably means that the chicks will go into the water and not survive, which takes out the whole breeding success for a single colony for a single year. And we've seen this happening now more and more frequently around Antarctica as Antarctica starts to warm. The sea ice is forming later and it's breaking up earlier. And we can track this at each individual colony. We do it every year now with the satellites, and we can see when the sea ice breaks up and if it takes out the colony at the time. It's a worrying trend. We know that sea ice in Antarctica is declining, that the season is getting shorter, And that has real implications for emperor penguins that use that sea ice as a breeding platform. And the population overall seems to be going down, and we're working on that at the moment. A lot of our work is trying to assess that population and look at the implications.
And how are you actually measuring these penguins? Like, is the resolution of satellite good enough that you can see individual penguins, or do you have other indicators?
Yes, you can see individual penguins, and one of my sort of projects at the moment is how accurately can we count individual penguins from space? Because you can see the The adults stand out as little black dot blobs on the satellite imagery. But those little emperor penguin chicks that you see on the documentaries, the little fluffy grey balls of fur, they're actually surprisingly well camouflaged on the ice, because they tend to be on quite dirty ice. So seeing them from space is more challenging.
And some of your work has also shown the discovery of some emperor penguin colonies that we didn't know existed. So almost a double-edged sword. We've got this really negative story of the decline of populations, but then also the improvement of technology to better estimate all the habitats where we didn't think penguins used to exist.
Well, absolutely. We've actually discovered twice as many colonies as we previously thought existed, and half of those have been by satellite, which is great news for emperor penguins, because there's twice as many as we thought, but that doesn't mean that their decline is going to be any easier or less dramatic. But it is good to find these new sites.
There's so many factors up against the survival of these penguins: anthropogenic pressures such as fishing and also global impacts of climate change. Do you feel optimistic towards the conservation of these species that you are so invested in?
Good question. It kind of changes day to day, really, potentially if we can find some solutions. But yeah, you can also see the effects of these birds when they have a bad year. It's very hard to be optimistic when literally some years we'll see thousands of penguin chicks just starving. It's kind of a mixed bag, really. There's some difficult conversations which we don't seem to want to have about climate change and how we can, what we do about that, really. As a species, we're very good at adapting, and hopefully that we can come up with some solutions. But yeah, it's not always easy to be positive about these things.
Peter, what's your opinion?
Well, yeah, you've got to be hopeful. Hope keeps you going, really. We know that things are going to get worse in the short term. Global warming and climate change is affecting huge numbers of species around the world. But for penguins, and emperor penguins specifically, their numbers are going down. The predictions are quite dire for them. But I still think that there is hope. We're going to lose most of them, I think, over the next few decades. But I think there's hope as long as humans can adapt and change around the pathway that we've got on at the moment. So I'm still hopeful that we can, but it is, you know, every year that we delay is a year closer to a really bad outcome for emperors and other species.
Is some of your work, Peter, having a policy level impact? Are you able to break that boundary between academia and policymakers?
Yeah, we do a lot of outreach work. We do a lot of work with the Antarctic Treaty and the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research to try and get that message out. One of the problems we have with emperors is that the conservation of emperors and their survival is really quite very linked to climate change. Climate change isn't a regional problem. You can't put the ice back in a local thing. You can't do anything regionally. You can't stop fishing, because fishing, in this case, unlike the smaller penguins, overfishing doesn't affect emperor penguins. It is almost purely climate change. And climate change is a global problem. So one of the best things we can do, really, for emperor penguins is use them as a sort of poster child for climate change, and use their what's happening to emperor penguins is showing people what the consequences, not just for this species, but for all species, of changing their environment. I think we just need to keep working on them, keep showing people what's happening to them, because actually conserving them on a local level is almost impossible, really.
Yeah, it's a global issue that we all have a part to play in, and we need to tackle it with some absolutely radical changes. Do you encounter challenges working at that policy level interface, Peter?
Oh, absolutely. You know, science, I wouldn't say it's black and white, but it's, you know, you can get scientific data and you can show something and you tell the truth and you tell it in as open and clear way as you can. But when it gets to the murky world of politics, there are always other things that are going to push in, and you'll get the Antarctic Treaty, we'll get countries and parties that have got different agendas, that don't want to conserve things in the same way as that we might want to conserve things. So there's often impasse and there's a lack of progress there that you really think, well, you know, but national agendas are different, and it is some parties will just sort of put their oar in and just take umbrage and say no, because they want to make a point on something totally different. So it's really hard for us as scientists who can see this thing happening and say, well, why aren't you doing this? To think, well, you know, often at that level, it's not always about the science. It's not always about sort of what the actual consequences or things are happening down in Antarctica. There's other political things going on that overwhelm that and mean that they don't listen to the science, which is really upsetting from my point of view.
It's hard to make people understand why penguins are important, because so few people do get to experience them. Like, obviously, we have all seen them and we are, as you say, privileged and lucky. But to bring this message home to people as to why their failures and successes matter to us is really, we just need to keep hammering this message home. So, absolutely. And Darren, to conclude, whilst we talk about penguins at Christmas, how will you and your team be celebrating?
So we'll have a fairly traditional UK Christmas. So there's five of us on station. So luckily this year, our station leader, who traditionally makes the Christmas dinner, is an ex-chef. So we've got high hopes this year. Last year I did it, which wasn't a complete disaster, but hopefully it should be a better spread this year. So yeah, we'll have the normal like turkey or nut roast and the rest of it, all the trimmings. And possibly maybe go out and have an afternoon sledging in the snow or something. We'll see what we can do, but we'll have like a nice kind of like almost like a family Christmas together. It's very important to look after each other and socialize and things like that. It's such a big part of what we do down here.
On that, actually, how do the team respond to your work? Do you get quite a lot of station support?
Yeah, people are always keen to come out and help me with my work. I don't really consider it work most of the time, so it's a special feeling when you can. And when somebody says, oh, I've always wanted to see a penguin, and you can actually put a penguin into their hands and say, just hold that for me a moment.
That is such a lovely ending. Peter, will any penguins be joining you for your Christmas dinner in Cambridge?
Unfortunately not. No, I'm still a long way from the penguins, and not doing any field work this year either. So I'll probably be going out next year, but not this year. But yeah, I've banned penguin themed Christmas presents this year as well. So because I do tend to get everybody buys me penguin stuff. Yeah. But other than that, it should be good, I think.
Well, I wish you a very Merry Christmas. You're both looking very festive. Obviously, the listeners can't see this, but Darren in your penguin T-shirt from Cygni and Peter in your Christmas jumper. Thank you very much for your time and talking to me. It's been great.
Merry Christmas.
And that's us concluding the Ice World podcast for the year of 2024. We will carry on season four, learning about science that's happening in Antarctica next year. And for Christmas, my present from you is to write a review for the Ice World podcast. It will really help us share and expand the message. Remember to check the job section of the British Antarctic Survey's website if you would like to see a penguin up close. That's all from us. Have a great Christmas and look forward to having you back in the new year.